A good day it is. Hello, Gallatin County. And you are listening to the Health and Happiness Show on Radio KGVM 95.9 FM or KGVM.org. This is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. We are co-hosts of this presentation on a show originally conceived to deal with mental health issues supported by the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association. We have done that for 7 years and also include a variety of other interesting scenarios, all dealing with health and happiness. Now, Dr. Suzanne introduces today's program.
What do the arts mean to humanity? Well, according to Pablo Picasso, every child is an artist. The problem is staying an artist when you grow up. Vincent van Gogh said, "If you hear a voice within you say, 'You cannot paint,' then by all means paint, and that voice will be silenced." Matisse said that creativity takes courage. And good old Andy Warhol said, "Don't think about making art, just get it done. Let everyone else decide if it's good or bad, whether they love it or hate it. While they're deciding, just make even more art." And André Gide said that art is a collaboration between God and the artist, and the less the artist does, the better. The art world. It's a splendid mystery to most of us. Poetry, painting, composing a sonata, writing an opera score, creating costumes for a show, executing a ballet performance, writing a novel, filmmaking. So many avenues depend totally on our society's artists. But how do we take care of them? By all accounts, it can be the most difficult of all of life's professions. In fact, I was amazed to meet an artist who literally had to break into a bank downtown in New York City to find a space to work. From the New York Times and many other news reports, please welcome Victor Jeffries II to share his artist's story. Hi, Victor.
How's it going, Suzanne? Hi, Arliss.
Hello.
It's going great here in Montana, and you said it's a pretty day up in New York City?
It's beautiful. It's sunny. The weather's changing. I'm doing my laundry. It's great. I'm feeling productive. It's a wonderful day.
That's just excellent. And speaking of doing your laundry, that would mean that you're at home in your home and artistic space. And that's a story that has fascinated everybody up there in the whole New York area. So you've lived in this place, what, almost 18 to 20 years now, Victor?
Yes. After university, I did a short stint in Washington, D.C. After I finished a project there, I was like, okay, let's move to New York. So I moved to New York with one bag of clothes. I stayed on a friend's couch, Paul Downs. We may know him from Hacks, for about a week and a half. And then I found my apartment on Craigslist. And that was 20 years ago. It'll be 20 years on October 15th is the day that I moved into my apartment. So I lived on the top floor of this building for 20 years. There's 6 units in the building. It was built in 1890. It's on the main thoroughfare in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, which has turned into a very hot, cool, hip neighborhood. And for 18 and a half of those years, the bottom floor of the bank, which is the retail space, was a Santander bank, which I believe is a Spanish-based bank. And, you know, I am an idiot sometimes, and I never opened a bank account down there, but I probably paid over the course of 20 years $400 in ATM fees, because every once in a while it would be 3 o'clock in the morning and I needed some cash, and I would go downstairs and pay the penalty as opposed to opening a bank account. Either way, at the end of 2023, the bank finished their lease. They left. And within 4 months, my landlords, who I've known for 20 years, and they've been in my apartment a lot. They love showing it off because I always have art up and I'm moving things around. And it's just a very wonderful space. I convinced them to have them teach me how to break into the bank. They told me, we will not give you a key. We'll teach you how to break in, and you cannot bring anybody in here, but you can make art. And it was such a wild opportunity. I was very grateful. So I started doing this. And so I would spend, you know, hours down there. It's a 5,000 square feet, huge walls. I'm making very big paintings, sculptures out of trash. After about doing this for 4 months, I convinced the landlords to give me a lease. And we have, you know, a lease. And they gave me a key and they charged me $1 a month. Obviously, the understanding is when they have a long-term tenant ready to pay market price for the space, I'll be out. So as with most things, nothing lasts forever. So I really, you know. Almost a year that I've been down there. And whenever I'm down there, the door is open. The community participates a lot. I literally have four new friends that are all under the age of 4 years old who love coming into the space to draw or hang out. And then I've hosted many community events and exhibitions that are open to the public. So it's become something, you know, part of the fabric of the neighborhood, which has been really fun. One of the pleasures of the whole project. So it's a wild thing that I've been given this opportunity. And it's also a reflection of the commercial real estate market in New York right now is very soft. So there's lots of open retail spaces. I happen to have a very strong relationship with the building's owner, and we came up with a kind of interesting interim use of the space. So it's been great.
Don't you? You haven't always had a key. Can you tell us about that?
When I didn't have a key?
Yeah.
How was the process of climbing through a hole or whatever you had to do?
I mean, that's literally what I had to do. I would go through the basement. They showed me this one piece of wall that would move. I would have to get on my hands and knees, crawl through a hole, and then have access to the bank where I would disarm an alarm, and then I had the space. But it was very tricky. You know, if I ever had to leave, if I left a paintbrush upstairs and needed to run out, it required me to come upstairs and then back through the hole. It was really, it was funny. But I was happy to do it.
Oh, this is just such an unbelievable story. Nobody would ever believe this in most of the lore of anything anywhere. It's just so amazing. And
we built these odd stories around landlords and tenants and how the relationship is somehow always acrimonious. So it is. It's like it's a very different type of relationship that we have.
Well, we can't be excited enough to hear about that story. Just for the fun of it, a lot of people here go up to New York. Give the address where people could come and see you should they happen to visit New York, or maybe somebody listening's in New York.
Yeah, it's 717 Manhattan Avenue in Brooklyn, and it's the southernmost edge of Greenpoint. It's right by McCarran Park. It's beside a very famous donut shop called Peter Pan that's been here for 70 years or something. And it's a cool little neighborhood. There's just lots going on, lots of great shops and food, and it's a good vibe over here.
You did say that rent wasn't bad where you live, is it?
Rent is very expensive where I live. It has become very, very expensive.
Oh, prohibitive, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could tell you a fun story that I pay, you know, $900 for my loft apartment. That is not the case. I definitely pay a lot of money to be here, but I'm holding on somehow. It's been working. But yes, the neighborhood has gotten very expensive.
Yeah, that's just happened all through Brooklyn recently, hasn't it?
Yeah, and this is kind of part of it is kind of ebb and flow of the city. I guess this is always happening, perpetually happening. But Brooklyn has definitely become very hot.
One thing I really like about you, Victor, is the variety of skills. It's like a Da Vinci kind of thing. You don't just do one thing. Kind of tell us, especially for the young artists or want to be artists out there in any field, tell us how you started out. I believe you were in dance and you worked with some celebrated groups. So kind of going deeper into the art world, tell us about how your beginnings shaped you and shaped this.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was very young, I guess I was a soccer, gymnastics kid, then the orchestra came along. Then when you were in grade 7, you could choose a different instrument other than the violin, so I chose the double bass. So music was a big part of my upbringing. My mom is from Costa Rica. My parents were together, so we would go back and forth between North Carolina and Costa Rica a lot. In Costa Rica, social dancing among friends, salsa, cumbia, merengue, this kind of stuff is it's kind of what people do, kids, young people do, or what you like would do with your aunt in the living room. So movement, body, you know, moving my body around to music was something that I was very accustomed to. It felt very natural. And so I was like in secondary school in North Carolina, I would be in the musicals and, you know, I would always get the dancing part. But it wasn't until I went to university, I went to Duke in North Carolina, my parents gave me my first digital camera. And I think basically since that moment, I haven't stopped taking pictures. And that was a fun way for me to interact with the world. And, you know, keep in mind, I was going to be a brain surgeon. I went to Duke. I minored in chemistry. I minored in music. I majored in cultural anthropology, and I did everything to go to medical school. So that was the idea. But always, like throughout my entire life, I was in a hedge fund for a long time. I've always been making things. It feels good. It's nice. It's better than kind of watching TV. It's a good way to kind of flex, exercise my brain, you know, in different ways. So yeah, it's always kind of making things has always been a way that I interact with the world. You know, I go on vacation and I always have a piece of paper and a bag of pencils and I'm drawing. And it's just a fun way to live life, I guess.
You just see everything around you. You totally absorb everything around you. And so you have a range of skills that's quite enviable. You tell us about designing stage sets and costumes for plays and events.
Yeah. Well, first off, I can't sew. Like, my friend taught me how to do the bobbin and thread the needle, and that's kind of the limitations of my sewing skills. But within that, you can still make things. I have a dear friend. His name is Murr. Everyone should look them up. I think it's Murr, New York. They're an incredible artist. They are an incredible musician and has written a number of operas. So I believe this was one of the, Murr and I get along very closely. We enjoy collaborating with one another. Our aesthetic propensities are in the same general direction. This person has like a love of life and is so grateful for just all the things and just such a great attitude. So I really enjoy working with Murr. Anyway, we've made now 3 operas together where Murr writes the libretto and the music. And then between the two of us, we make sets and we make them, you know, with basically no money. You kind of find trash. There's a wonderful organization in New York City called Materials for the Arts, which is run by New York City. It is based in Queens. And basically it's an organization that if you're a big company, any type of company, fashion house, or you just finished a Broadway show or just finished shooting a television show or something, you would donate, all of these companies donate office furniture when they're moving or when something goes out of business or when the project is over to this Materials for the Arts. If you're affiliated with a 501c3 here in New York City, you can make appointments at Materials for the Arts and go and take whatever they have for free. So Murr and I, through the support of a 50 theater here in the city that produced our work, we would go to Materials for the Arts and you kind of see what they have. And from that, you find creative solutions to build sets. And, you know, we just have to always, like, keep it fun and keep it light. And it's not the end of the world if we don't get exactly what we want. And it's not the end of the world if it's not, you know, it falls down in the middle of it, in the middle of the production. Or, you know, we just always try to keep it light. You know, there are people who can't eat or don't have a place to sleep at night. Like, those are serious things. So, you know, I always try to keep those ideas in mind too and not get too serious about some of these projects. And I think that levity, the childness of it, you know, brings freedom and creative ideas, and it, like, makes you feel good, like, it about being alive and making things.
That's fantastic. And did you two collaborate and go to Paris recently?
No, I did a project. Murr and I have done three separate productions at two different theaters in the city. And our last one was, we're bumping up on about a year ago. And we're starting another project now. But no, the Paris project, I'm always kind of getting involved with artists, is an artist based in Hawaii. Taiji Taraseki has a solo show in Paris that just closed 2 days ago. So I collaborated with him on what this his installation would look like. So again, that was more me supporting his artistic vision, but I like those collaborations.
That's amazing that you collaborate with the artists and are so much help to them to realize their vision or their need for a certain creative level. How do you do that, Victor?
Well, it can be it's a sacred space, right?
Yeah.
It can be very vulnerable when an artist is exploring ideas. It can be very vulnerable to be open to other people's opinions about how things are working. So I am always very humbled and cognizant of how sacred of that space, you know, sacred that space is when I'm invited there. So, you know, and I generally try to work with people who are open to collaborating. You know, it's tricky for me to work with someone who is very my way or no way. I'm always right. You know, everybody's always wrong. That's a harder energy to work with. I've done it before, not my preference. But yeah, it's about kind of building trust and making sure that people know this is your project, not mine. I'm offering these ideas as more tools for you. I'm not going to get hurt if you don't incorporate any of them. And I'm not going to get, you know, I'm not going to freak out if you incorporate all of them. So you just kind of have to endlessly provide ideas and opportunities and have no, you know, not be attached to them.
Oh, that's so smart. You're not putting them in a difficult spot by saying, you must love my ideas. You're saying, here are ideas. Do you like any of them?
Yeah, take them or leave them. And, you know, I personally also have to keep in mind, I'm not going to feel, I shouldn't feel bad if someone doesn't like my ideas. It's just an idea, not a, you know, yeah. No big deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, to someone out there hoping to do some of these things, how do you make these connections? How might you advise a young person, like you just went to New York? How did you make these connections? Was it through your university contacts, or did you just go and meet people in the art settings? How did you go about that, Victor?
Yeah, I think there are two things that were productive for me that were happening at the same time. One, highly social. I was out all the time. When you're young and in a place like New York City, so this is like specific to places that have like social kind of opportunities, go out all the time. Constantly everybody should be out four nights a week because you're young and you can do it. Watch your drinking, you know, be careful with the drugs, this kind of stuff. Have fun, enjoy, but meet as many people as you can. Not because you're trying to get things out of them, but it's been one of the pleasures of my life is to see some of my friends that I've known for two decades succeed. Like, you meet these wonderful people and you kind of see how it all, you know, rolls out for them, or, you know, it's interesting. So whatever, be out and meeting lots of people. The other thing is, which is not dependent on where you are, is always make things. Like, it is very frustrating as a person who takes lots of photos when I hear people talk about they're kind of a photographer, they want to be a photographer, but they don't have the newest camera, or they don't have enough money to like buy that digital camera that they need in order to be a photographer. That to me is like, you don't need, people have been taking incredible pictures with a box and a hole in it for 200 years. Like, there are no excuses for us to be able to make things constantly and just keep making things. Like, whatever, Nike, just do it. Like, it is very easy for us to come up with excuses to not do the painting or write the play or, you know, take the photo. It's very easy to do that, and I've done it before, and I probably will do it again. Come up with an excuse not to continue to make, but you just have to do it. Like, keep making things no matter what, for yourself, for other people. Like, it's a practice. It's a thing that there needs to be discipline around, and you just kind of keep making whatever it is that you're making.
Such good advice. And I saw a quote from Michelangelo who said, if people knew how hard I worked to get my mastery, it wouldn't seem so wonderful at all.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we definitely, age of TikTok, this kind of stuff, it's like, we're seeing these 30-second videos of artists making a beautiful whatever it is, instrument, composition, painting, bag, pair of pants, and it seems so easy. It only shows you, I mean, it makes it seem like it took them an afternoon to make the thing. We're not, you know, you don't see the work many times in the way culture kind of shows us how art is made. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm making sense.
It is making sense, Victor, very much. And Degas said that painting is easy when you don't know how, but very difficult when you do.
Yeah, one thing, I have tons of friends who come over a lot, whether it's in the bank or in my apartment, and I always have things to make art, and people get very, oh, I don't know how to paint, I'm not an artist, I don't have an artistic bone, this kind of stuff. An exercise that I do with my friends is, you know, white sheet of paper, marker, or paint, or whatever you're doing, but put the tool in your non-dominant hand, and then make whatever it is that you're making. And what it does is that people then no longer feel like they are responsible or kind of on the hook for whatever comes out on their painting, because you're handicapping them, right? You're making them use their non-dominant hand. So it becomes more fun and more loose, and people kind of just start drawing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like when you release the expectation of this being good, quote unquote, or this looking a certain way, or my skill set to be able to paint, you can release that by, like, you know, using your non-dominant hand, and you know it's going to be quote unquote bad. But then you get your hand moving and suddenly, you know, you start to learn things. So I do like this idea of not less serious about the practice, but, you know, maintaining a whimsical, it doesn't matter kind of feeling around it.
Fascinating. You know, there's a whole lot of concern, especially from parents at times, about their kids going into the art world. And so, you know, the Arts to Hearts Project talked about some of the biggest problems in the art world in the different artists' opinions. And so one of them said that you should make it clear to young artists and art students that if you want to be a professional artist, you're also going to be a business owner. They need to teach business in the art schools. How do you feel about that? Because not only does an artist have to be creative and create, but then he has to be a business person to be able to manage.
1,000%. And I think, you know, I believe in evolution. I think the mushy stuff in between our ears has incredible capacity. So we can do all of this stuff. It's not like we have to decide I'm only going to be the finance dude, or I'm only going to be an artist. Like, our brains can do all of it. Some of those skill sets are more interesting to us than others, but you definitely need to, like, yeah, you know, learn a little bit more about taxes, understand how, you know, budgets, being able to talk to people on the phone and negotiate, you know, contracts, thinking about your rights as an artist. When you make a piece of work, think, you know, easy examples like photographs, like attribution, if they use it in 3 years, who actually owns the image, this kind of stuff. It's important. And it's fun because it's like, art is kind of like, sometimes it's kind of, you know, you have to make your, we're making money. Like, the art that we make turns into money. So it's kind of like printing money, which means we have to understand money a little bit. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So the skill sets, for sure, like, are, you know, and listen, I hate doing my taxes, but it is a thing that I do, and it's not always fun. And, you know, I think people should pay taxes, but just the having to keep up with all the stuff is, like, not fun for me. But you do it, and it feels good. And, you know, I ask for help when I need it. But it's all important if you're ever going to try to kind of grow any type of business or idea or push something forward along in life. It's important to know this stuff.
And so that's valuable information for young and any age artistry people wanting to go into the field. I don't know if you've heard of Margherita Tebaldo, but she's an artist from Italy. And she said, "I'm an artist," might be one of the scariest things I've ever said. It all started when I was a teenager in Italy. I was surrounded by family and friends who loved my artwork, but never encouraged me to pursue art. There's an Italian saying that goes, "Impara d'arte, Mattia," which means learn art and put it on the side. That was me every time I would say that quote, because I couldn't understand how people could say such a thing and yet be surrounded by the wonderful art in Italy. And to finish the story, she overcame all the misgivings of her family and society about whether you should actually try to be an artist and make a living or not. And she became very successful. So I'd like for you to maybe advise parents on how to help their young persons who might be interested in any manner or measure of the art world.
I know it seems scary. I mean, yeah, parents, we want to protect our children and we want the best for them, for sure. I think ultimately at the end of the day, we want people to be happy. I want people to be happy. I want people to be as fully expressed as they can be, as long as they don't get in the way of other people being fully expressed. The worst is when you have students go and do pre-med and go to medical school or go to law school knowing that they don't actually really like this. And suddenly they've put 15 years and, you know, tons of money into this thing, and then they're miserable the rest of their lives. So that's another, you know, encouraging. We want to encourage everybody to find their passion and these days you can make money kind of doing almost anything. It's not easy. Committing to making art, not easy at all. But nothing's really easy. Like, very rarely are things just easy. And the way the world is going these days, nothing is secure, you know? There are tons of people that are leaving university with lots of debt and can't get a job. And they did exactly what they were supposed to do, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, somehow art feels scarier, and it does. It feels, to make the statement, I'm an artist, it is. Like, it's, you know, you're taking a stance, and it's a thing. But like with any project, even if you want to be the best options trader in the world, it takes a lot of work and discipline and time. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And when it doesn't, you try again. So yeah, I mean, I understand. It's like scary. People are, my mom probably doesn't really understand how I pay for all my bills. Sometimes I don't understand how I pay, but it works. So I understand, you know, it's much easier to explain to someone, oh yeah, my kid is a nurse, or my kid is a teacher, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, being an artist many times is a little slipperier of a concept.
Yeah, as Margarita Tibaldo said at the beginning, I had mixed feelings about pursuing art. I had the deepest desire to paint, create, and make, but also the fear of not being able to succeed. And she said, I almost forgot another quote I've been told multiple times. It is not going to be easy, but she goes on to say that working a job we do not like and enjoy is not easy either.
Exactly.
We just have to choose what is worth working hard for.
Totally.
And that's where you are, Victor, showing us how to go about it. Yes. What do you think about the new entrant to the art world, artificial intelligence?
You know, I think of it like another tool. It's another paintbrush. It's another can of paint. It's a tool that we will use. Does it impact all markets? Absolutely. You know, so did the, you know, the making of cars in a factory line on a belt. Like, it just, with machines, like, it, less people worked. Or people, which means, you know, I think the people who lose in that AI discussion are the people who refuse to play with it and learn it. AI, I don't think, is going to take our jobs. It's people who learn how to use AI that will take our jobs. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I do. I think of it as a tool. It is, I mean, it's pretty incredible and weird and crazy, and it's very complicated, can be very complicated morally and this kind of stuff. Environmentally, there are all these things that are happening. It's a really interesting tool, and can be a great brainstorm. I love a brainstorm, and, you know, just can kind of throw out ideas that are nice.
I love that you've put my mind a little bit at rest there. I saw it as almost like an imposter or an invader, but you're saying it could be a wonderful tool just to generate creative ideas and distances you might not have seen before. So, okay, I feel much better about that.
Do you think that with AI, that, let's say, some kind of production of art, it ought to be labeled by AI versus Victor, for example?
Yeah. I could be wrong, but I think in France for a while they had this thing where if there was a public advertisement that had been photoshopped, it had to be labeled in a certain kind of way. And, you know, it's an interesting idea. I don't think people should lie about it, deceive people, you know, deep fakes, getting people to say things they didn't really say, and not, you know, that deceitful use of AI, like, not good. Does it need to be labeled? I guess it just should be like, I don't think there should be necessarily a label on it, but there should be a way to know, you know, and for people not to hide that AI was used. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something in there. Not required, but it's just you're learning something about people who are trying to hide that they've used it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So let's not hide it and just be real with what it is. I used AI to do this. Okay.
Well, you've set my mind at rest, Victor. Thank you. Yeah, and, you know, another thought that concerns me about the art world is plagiarism. An artist creates a textile design or painting, and then some random company prints that design on towels and gets a lot of money. Could you tell us about the morality for those people who've created the art and how all of us around you, our dear artists, should respect and what we should know about that?
Conceptually, I believe that good ideas should be stolen, and it is one should be flattered if your idea is stolen. That being said, we should always punch up. So if you make a drawing and suddenly Target, multi-billion-dollar, you know, huge company, turns your drawing into a towel and completely cuts you out of any type of financial gain from the sale of this product, that's bad. That's like morally bad. If I see your drawing, redraw it myself, and use that as a starting point for my next series of plant drawings, that's great. Like, if I'm trying to recreate an image that Avedon took, you know, it's a good exercise for me to try to do that. And in doing that exercise, I'll probably learn something. And I'll also, once I've recreated the Avedon image, I'll have a skill set that I can apply in the ways that I want to apply. Does that make sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's, you know, while it is an ultimate form of flattery to be stolen from, that doesn't make it feel good. I mean, I've had it happen to me in little ways. And it's like, ugh, that is so gross. Like, but it's fine. It is ultimately, if you think about it, it's someone telling you how much they like what it is that you are making. But again, with the caveat, we can, you know, steal whatever we want from Target and put it in our art, fine. Yeah. But Target stealing from us to make their product, not good, not okay.
Fascinating.
That sounds like, in the world of sports, particularly college sports, they've wrestled with the idea of name, image, and likeness, the NIL
yes.
stuff. It sounds like that's related in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, yeah, those kids playing sports at these big schools generating tons of money off of those three things. They should be able to participate in that, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Voltaire, the artist, would agree. He said, originality is nothing but judicious imitation.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, yes, it would be considered a great compliment for someone to steal your ideas, but also perhaps a certain level of immorality there. So we should all be considerate. And I appreciate that discussion about it, Victor.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about who are we stealing from. You know, if we're stealing from the people who don't have much, the lowly artists, that's bad. You're stealing from, like, Amazon, you know, some artistic idea from Amazon, I think that's okay.
Sounds like Robin Hood.
Yeah. It's about punching up and punching okay. down. Never punch down. Always punch up.
What about those fake artists who've been promoted hugely? They get millions of dollars for just splashing some paint on random objects and calling it art, while actual artists with talent are barely surviving. Do you feel like that is true art, or is it a manipulation?
I mean, you know, age-old question, what is art? In my mind, a big characteristic is about intent. And, you know, if the splash paint person who got a deal with a cruise line and is selling $15 million worth of splatter paintings, good for them, you know?
Okay.
you know, it's yeah. And then in terms of like assessing its artistic value, you know, you would maybe want to think a little bit about like, what was that person's intent? If it was to make money, that's one thing. If it's to actually communicate an idea or engage a, you know, what does a painting mean, or, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, it's a different perspective from where the work comes from.
Wasn't there a guy recently who somehow, see if I got this correct, had a banana in a painting and then ate it? Some kind of, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. It was a banana that was duct taped to a wall and sold for like, at Christie's, I believe, for a number of million dollars.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, that kind of art. Tell
well,
us
in
about
my mind,
that.
You know, the artists that are making that, they are making it with the intent of engaging this notion of how ridiculous the art world is, the notions of, like, commerce, the notions of where is value, you know, Duchamp and the whole toilet thing, you know. He said, this is art, therefore it was art. And that's, as a conceptual conceit, that is a perspective that the artist is coming from. We may not like it as outside consumers of the thing, but the artist who made that was thinking about the ridiculousness of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think that's a fair, and look what it's done. Like, we're talking about it.
Exactly.
So this artistic, you know, this manifestation of art moved a conversation forward or continued a conversation, and that's a big part of the power of art. So in my, you know, I would argue that that's, it's not necessarily good or bad, but it's definitely art. It's like that artist was thinking about commerce and art and these lines.
That reminds me, Suzanne and I, in watching television sometimes, see a lot of insurance commercials. And say, oh, man, I hate that. That's awful. Don't those guys, but you know what? We're talking about it. We talk about it over and over, like, oh,
yeah.
An ostrich, what's the deal, you know? So, yeah.
It's commerce, and he's pointing something out that's very true. And I love your metacognitive overview, Victor, that, yes, here's art, but then here's somebody looking it over and trying to determine what it's all about. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you for your perspective. I've gained a lot of new perspectives today. And I was just wondering, one thing that we read about a whole lot would be called artistic blocks. How do you circumnavigate, if you've ever had a block, how do you get past that? What would you say about that, Victor?
One thing is those are definite moments where I recognize the value of having a practice. So treating it like a job. By that I mean every day for 2 hours I do this thing. Or every day I'm in the studio for whether I want to do it or not, unless I'm bedridden with an illness, like this is what I am doing. And that consistency, it's kind of like going to the gym or keeping a diet. That consistency in doing it every day, whether we enjoy it or not, gets us into a rhythm and into a habit. And then when we feel like there are no ideas, if you just kind of keep the pen moving, or keep just writing words on the page, even if they make no sense, that really is helpful. It's just to keep moving. That being said, I recently, for one of the first times in my life, had like a 6-week period where I was like not doing anything. And it was, that's very not like me. And it was very odd experience to just kind of sit around. But sometimes that's what's required, you know? you have to give yourself a break sometimes. And then there's sometimes where there's just no ideas, and that's okay. They will come again for sure. And we must continue to exercise, you know, these muscles in our brains and our bodies during those periods, because that will help, you know, make the ideas come.
Yeah. An excellent writer, Kurt Vonnegut, said to practice any art, no matter how well or how badly, is a way to make your soul grow. So for heaven's sake, do it.
Yeah.
Like every day is what you're saying, with an occasional bit of rest from it.
Yeah, I mean, think of it like a job. It is a job. And you're only going to get better by putting in the time. And it's not always fun or easy. And ultimately, every time we do it, we're getting, you know, marginally better, mm-hmm. and or closer to the thing that's trying to come out of our brain. And, you know, all those little marginal increments add up.
And so writers like Kurt Vonnegut, and here's Yo-Yo Ma talking about music. Passion is one great force that unleashes creativity. Because if you're passionate about something, then you're more willing to take risks.
Yeah, totally.
And so, living in the art world, we really appreciate the risks that you're taking, because what if artists didn't take those risks? What if we didn't do those things that have done so much for our entire civilization?
Yeah.
And you know, people in other professions don't have to compete with 200-year-old bookkeepers or whatever, but artists have to compete with Da Vinci and Michelangelo. Yeah. So you guys have a really hard path sometimes to me, because historically there's already such an art world, and how do you break into that? So it takes courage, as one of our writers said before. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And also, you know, there are some places in the world that are more supportive of artists than others. You know, there are a number of places in France where you could get, for example, government health insurance as a freelancer. That's very much more difficult to do here.
Yes.
There are also, you know, the executive director of most any nonprofit in this country, their main job is to, you know, convince rich people to give them money. Whereas in Europe, a lot of those same, you know, many times art institutions, for example, they're funded by the government. So an executive director of a opera house in Sweden, they actually get to focus on the art. So it's a, you know, it can be a different thing to how artists are taken care of or cared for or considered, you know, in different countries.
Exactly. When you think about it, if you're a writer, you have to write your script or your book or whatever before you ever see anything. And you don't know when you start if you're ever going to see anything. If you're making an opera, you have to do all the work before you ever get any kind of response. So it is, I would think, one of the more courageous fields that exists.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yeah, it is. It's a thing. We put in lots of work, yeah, to your point, where you basically have to make it, and then you put it out there and see if it's going to work. There's less of an iterative process or a definitive goal or product that's coming out in ways that other jobs have very clear kind of metrics of success. Does that make sense?
Yes.
What about the learning or teaching of art? I know in almost everything you have to learn certain basics before one can say one is creative. In most cases, there may be some people who seem to be just naturally, they begin create with creativity before they learn technique. But let's say learning about what kind of paper or easel or brush or colors to use that everybody would have to learn before they can move to the next step. Is that the way it happens?
I've never been to art school. I've never taken an art class. I've always joked about, like, well, what are they going to actually teach? You know, what are they teaching in an art class? Kind of to your point of creativity and then skill set. So I would imagine the most valuable parts of art school would be having time and space to make art. The other being you are offered many opportunities to learn different skills so that you can figure out, you know, do I like metal work? Do I like painting? Once you get into the painting, as you deepen your practice and learn more about techniques, you can figure out, oh, I want to, you know, make a painting of a sky and I want it to shimmer in this certain kind of way. And suddenly, because you studied these 17 techniques, different techniques for painting, you know what type of paint to use or what surface to use or not use. So, you know, in a from a institutional education perspective, you know, they kind of lay it out for you and it's nice and you have smart people around you that can help you along the way. Is that necessarily required? No. Like, you know, you just start making things and see what works and what doesn't and pivot. And the internet is awesome. Like, you can ask it lots of questions and it'll give you at least a good starting point to how to figure things out. You know, take classes. You can learn anything on YouTube. I'm not suggesting to not go to art school, but again, a lot of this stuff is available to us. It's much easier for us to make excuses. I don't have an MFA. I don't know how to mix the oil paint, you know, which keeps me from making the painting. Instead of being like, I'm going to watch a 5-minute YouTube video and just try this. I'm going to spend $25 on this and, you know, paint for 2 days and see what happens. That's kind of, you know, I don't know. That's kind of the way I think about it. But again, I haven't been to art school. Well, I also think another fun part about art school would be art history. Like, you learn about what other people have made, which is a great way to get ideas and see how other people have done it. Or, you know, yeah, find that awesome idea to steal and iterate on. I think that would be a fun part. But again, you can do that on your own with discipline and the internet too.
Well, Pablo Picasso agrees with you. He said, inspiration does exist, but it must find you working.
Yeah, I believe that. Because if you're not working, your brain isn't engaged with the world to be able to receive, you know, the idea and the inspiration.
Rousseau said the world of reality has its limits, but the world of imagination is boundless. So that's where you are, Victor, in the world of imagination.
Yeah, I mean, I it's a nice place to be. It's, as we've been talking about a little bit, it can be a little scary because, you know, sometimes you don't know up from down. But there are lots of possibilities and lots of solutions and lots of opportunity in the space of imagination.
And Charles Cooley said, an artist cannot fail. It is a success to be one.
I buy that.
Me too. Now, from another art expert, Dr. Seuss, he said, be who you are and say what you feel, because those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind.
I love Dr. Seuss.
Yes. So we've talked about artists of all kinds today, music, writing, stagecraft, film, and just every kind of art, and your photography. So, Victor, we're getting on toward the end here now. Would you give a way to reach you, whether email, phone, and your address again, all your connections, so that people wanting to see and hear more of your work, and we really recommend your photography, could reach you?
Yeah, thanks. So I take lots of pictures, and I keep a little blog on my website, which updates very regularly, and it's just kind of documenting my life. So it's Victor Jeffries, so it's V-I-C-T-O-R, jefferreys.com/blog. So that's a fun way to like see lots of, you know, photos that I'm taking on a very regular basis. And if you're in New York and I'm still in the bank, you should come visit. Again, it's in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. It's 717 Manhattan Avenue. There are no regular hours. It's, you know, when I'm there, the door is open and you are welcomed. And I'm there a lot. Yeah. And on Instagram, I'm Victor Jefferies II. Where I'm constantly, you know, making things. So I would love for you to check it out. And you can, through my website, easily reach out to me or Instagram. I'd be happy to hear from you.
And have we said that you have been featured in an article in the New York Times recently?
Yeah, I was at this, I worked at Gawker for many years and became very close with lots of journalists. And so when this bank situation was unraveling, I was like, I have to pitch this to them. So I found a friend and we pitched their editor and they wrote it up, and it was a really fun story.
There have been several other magazines or groups that have told that story as well. Is that correct, Victor?
Yep. There's an awesome website that is about our neighborhood. It's called Green Pointers. They covered it. And then I've had, you know, different little events that were covering specifically the event. But it's fun. It's a fun place. I'm glad the community is able to participate.
Well, we just can't thank you enough for sharing some of your artistic time with us, Victor. And we'll look forward to coming to visit that wonderful spot. Hopefully you'll be there for a while longer.
Fingers crossed.
Yes.
Thank you both for having me. This was really fun.
Thank you, Victor. And to the Gallatin Valley audience, go to Brooklyn, visit Victor, look at his website, get a copy of the New York Times recent article about the person who lived in the bank and crawled through a wall to get there for a while. We thank you, Victor, very much. And Gallatin Valley, listen to this program at 7 o'clock on Mondays evening or at 9 o'clock on Thursday mornings. And we love you, Gallatin Valley. Keep listening to Health and Happiness, 95.9 KGVM FM. And we'll see you later.